Imagine spending 8 months putting together a $50 million private equity deal.
Oh, wow.
Right. I mean, the contracts are signed, the wire transfer is clear, the champagne is popped in the boardroom,
Yeah.
and your legal team is just, high-fiving.
The dream scenario.
Exactly. And then 1 year later, an SEC regulator knocks on your door and tells you the entire deal's illegal.
Ouch.
Yeah. You have to give all the money back, all 50 million.
Plus interest, usually.
Plus interest out of your own pocket. And why? Because you let one single investor buy into the deal who had just financed a fleet of like neon green jet skis.
That's the nightmare right there.
It really is. So welcome to this custom deep dive on investor qualification and resales.
I'm ready.
This episode is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com. So we're going to map out the regulatory minefield that governs private securities today. Because for anyone prepping for the Series 82 exam, this isn't just, trivia.
Right, it's your actual job on the line.
Exactly. You are going to be tested constantly and from literally every angle on who is legally allowed to sit at the table in a private deal. We're talking about the gatekeepers of capital, right? Accredited investors, qualified institutional buyers, and qualified purchasers.
Yeah, and the overarching mission here, the thing you really have to grasp is understanding the friction.
Friction, right?
Because when we talk about public markets, like buying shares of Apple or Microsoft on your retail brokerage app, that market is heavily democratized.
Anyone can do it.
Right, it's frictionless because those public companies have been forced through this absolute crucible of SEC registration. They file massive prospectuses, quarterly reports, audited
All
financials.
heavy paperwork.
Exactly. The government forces transparency so that anyone, regardless of their actual financial literacy, can theoretically play in that sandbox safely.
But the moment you step into the world of private offerings and restricted securities, all that transparency just vanishes.
Poof, it's gone.
You are buying into opaque, illiquid deals. And because the SEC isn't forcing the company to hand you a neatly packaged prospectus, they shift the burden, don't they?
They completely shift it. The government mandates that the investor must be sophisticated enough to fend for themselves.
Which brings us back to the stakes of the Series 82 and that nightmare scenario I opened with.
Right, blowing the exemption.
Blowing the exemption. The Securities Act of 1933 generally demands that every single sale of a security has to be registered with the SEC, unless there is a specific exemption.
And Regulation D provides a massive exemption for private placements.
Yeah.
But like you said, it is totally conditional.
Meaning if you break the rules, the exemption vaporizes. So let's look at the mechanics of what happens when that exemption blows up. I mean, this is not just a slap on the wrist or a fine, is it?
Oh, a fine is honestly the least of your worries. Yeah. If you, as the brokering representative, accidentally sell restricted paper to someone who doesn't legally qualify, like someone who padded their balance sheet with those jet skis you mentioned, the SEC can rule that your private placement was actually an illegal, unregistered public offering.
And that triggers the big one.
Yes, the right of rescission.
Okay, listener, if you're taking notes, highlight that term in your mind, the right of rescission. It's basically the financial equivalent of hitting a massive undo button, but like only when it hurts the issuer.
That's a great way to put it. The mechanism of rescission gives every single investor in that offering the legal right to demand their original investment back.
Plus statutory interest, right?
Plus statutory interest, minus any income received. And here's the kicker. If the private deal is going great, the investors will just keep their shares. They won't say a word.
Obviously, they're making money.
But if the investment goes south, which, let's be real, private deals often do, those investors will suddenly miraculously realize the offering was non-compliant.
Oh, I'm sure they will.
Right. And they will exercise their right of rescission. They force the company to buy back the completely worthless shares at the original price.
Which just bankrupts the company. The sponsors get investigated, the investors are furious, and your career as a licensed finance professional is effectively over.
Yep. You are the gatekeeper. The liability sits squarely on your shoulders.
So, to help you internalize these gatekeeping rules for the exam, and honestly, to keep us from getting bogged down in just dry, abstract legal theory, we are going to rely on a recurring cast of characters today.
I love this. Let's meet the cast.
We have three people you are going to hear about a lot. First, there's Riley the Rep.
Riley Rep.
Riley is newly minted Series 82 license holder. He works for a broker dealer, and his entire job is trying to execute private trades and earn his commissions without accidentally triggering a rescission nightmare and breaking federal law.
A stressful existence.
Very. Second, we have Ingrid the investor. Ingrid is a wealthy, super enthusiastic individual. She desperately wants to get her money out of standard, boring mutual funds and get in on the exclusive, high-yield private deals that Riley is brokering.
Okay, Ingrid wants in. And the third.
Finally, we have Sam the sponsor. Sam is an ambitious dealmaker. He's the guy actually putting together the private equity funds, the special purpose vehicles, the real estate syndications.
He's the one raising the money.
Exactly. Sam is always hungry for capital, and he is always pushing the absolute boundaries of what the regulations allow.
Sounds like a classic sponsor.
Doesn't he? So, listener, I'm asking you directly, are you ready to think like an SEC enforcement attorney? Because that is exactly what it takes to pass this section.
You really have to get into that paranoid regulator mindset.
Exactly. So, our first major regulatory hurdle is defining the entry fee for human beings. Let's say Sam, the sponsor, has a new private deal. He wants to raise capital under Rule 506B or 506C of Regulation D. Riley the rep is brokering it, and Ingrid wants in.
Okay, the stage is set.
The very first thing Riley has to do is prove that Ingrid meets the definition of an accredited investor. Because if she's not accredited, she generally cannot buy those restricted shares.
Right. And for natural persons, which is just the SEC's incredibly clinical terminology for a breathing human being, as opposed to a faceless corporation, there are two massive wealth-based pathways to get that accredited status.
The net worth test and the income test.
Exactly. Let's attack the net worth test first. The core rule here states that a natural person, either individually or jointly with their spouse or spousal equivalent, must have a net worth exceeding $1 million.
$1 million.
But the critical caveat, the part the exam will just relentlessly test you on, is that this $1 million calculation must strictly exclude the value of the investor's primary residence.
Exclude the primary residence.
Oh.
Now, this seems straightforward on paper, but I want to dive into the history of why this rule exists. Because for my ADHD brain, understanding the why makes the exam question so much easier to navigate.
It gives a context.
Exactly. Because before the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, the primary residence was actually included in this calculation, wasn't it?
It was. And the 2008 financial crisis exposed a massive, glaring flaw in the SEC's logic on that.
Because of the housing bubble.
Exactly.
Right.
During the bubble, you had regular, everyday people, teachers, middle managers who bought homes in California or Florida in like the late 90s. By 2007, those homes had just ballooned in paper value.
So suddenly these people had $1 million in home equity.
Right. On paper, they were accredited investors. So brokers sold them highly complex, entirely illiquid private securities.
And when the housing market collapsed,
their wealth vanished overnight. They lost their homes and they were stuck holding restricted private paper they couldn't sell and didn't even understand in the first place.
Which is just a disaster. So the regulatory fallout was pretty swift, right?
Oh, yeah. Congress realized that living in a house that happens to appreciate in a massive real estate bubble does not magically impart financial sophistication.
Like, being lucky in real estate doesn't mean you know how to read a private equity term sheet.
Precisely. Wealth tied up in the roof over your head does not provide the liquid capital needed to absorb a massive loss in a private placement. So they changed the law. The primary residence is entirely stripped from the equation.
So let's put Ingrid through the ringer here. Listener, I want you to actually calculate this in your head right now.
Let's hear it.
Ingrid owns $3 million in contemporary art. She has a stock portfolio of $2 million. And her primary residence is this sprawling mansion worth $5 million.
Sounds nice.
It is. She owns everything free and clear, absolutely zero debt. Is she accredited?
Well, even if we take a giant red pen and completely cross out that $5 million house, her art and her stocks add up to $5 million in pure assets.
So she's easily over the line.
She is well over the $1 million threshold. She is accredited.
But, you know, the real world involves debt. Nobody just owns a $5 million mansion outright, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the mechanics of a mortgage. Let's say Ingrid has a house worth $2 million.
Okay.
She holds a mortgage on that house for $1 million. The rule says we exclude the primary residence as an asset. But what is Riley supposed to do with that massive $1 million mortgage liability? Does that count against her other assets?
This is a crucial mechanical point for the Series 82. The rule demands symmetry.
Symmetry, yeah.
If you are forced to exclude the house as an asset, you are also permitted to exclude the mortgage debt secured by that house as a liability.
Oh, interesting.
But, and this is a massive but, you can only exclude the mortgage up to the fair market value of the home.
So in my baseline example, the house was 2 million, the mortgage is 1
Oh,
million.
right. So we ignore the house completely and we completely ignore the mortgage. Neither of them impacts her final net worth calculation at all.
Okay, that seems totally fair. But the SEC knows that human nature is, sneaky. People will always try to game the system. And this brings us to what I think is the most dangerous trap in the net worth calculation.
Ah, 60-day look-back rule.
The 60-day look-back rule. This is a regulatory tripwire designed to catch artificial balance sheet padding. Let's create an absurd scenario to illustrate exactly how this tripwire functions.
Lay it on me.
Listener, picture this. Ingrid desperately wants into Sam, the sponsor's new biotech private placement. She's utterly convinced this startup will cure male pattern baldness and she will just make $1 billion.
A worthy cause.
Naturally. But she is short on cash. Her actual net worth, excluding her house, is sitting at exactly $900,000.
So she needs another 100 grand to hit the magic million. She is just under the line. She needs liquidity.
Exactly. Now, Ingrid owns her house free and clear. It's worth $1 million. She goes to her local bank exactly 59 days before Sam's private deal is scheduled to close. She takes out a home equity loan for $200,000.
Okay, the plot thickens.
The bank wires the cash into her checking account. Ingrid then takes some of that cash and buys a fleet of neon green jet skis.
As one does.
As one does when trying to look rich. She sends Riley the rep her new balance sheet. It shows her original $900,000 in assets, plus a checking account fat with cash, plus a literal fleet of jet skis. On paper, her assets are now over 1.1 million. She crosses her fingers. Does this work? Can Riley let her in?
I'll give the listener a second to think about it.
Okay, time's up.
The SEC absolutely refuses to let phantom home equity mask real-world insolvency. This completely failed.
Fails. Why?
Because the 60-day look-back rule dictates that any increase in mortgage debt incurred during the 60 days immediately preceding the purchase of the securities must be counted as a liability.
Let's break down the math on that because visualizing it is the absolute key to passing the test. Ingrid added $200,000 in cash and jet ski assets to her balance sheet. Awesome.
Right. Assets went up.
But because she took on that new debt within the 60-day window right before the private placement, Riley the rep cannot ignore it. Even though it is secured by her primary residence, Riley is legally forced to count that $200,000 home equity loan as a harsh liability.
The artificial asset injection is totally neutralized by the regulatory liability inclusion. The new assets and the new liability perfectly cancel each other out.
So her calculated net worth remains trapped at $900,000. She is not an accredited investor.
Exactly. She's out.
Are there any exceptions to that 60-day rule? Like, what if she actually just bought a house?
Yes, that's the one exception. If Ingrid took out the mortgage to actually buy the primary residence in the first place, say she buys a new house 10 days before the deal, the SEC isn't going to punish her for a legitimate housing transaction.
Okay, that makes sense. They're not trying to stop people from moving.
Right. They are strictly hunting for people leveraging their shelter to gamble on high-risk private securities just to cross an arbitrary wealth threshold. They want to see genuine established wealth. They want a buffer.
Okay, so that covers the sneaky jet ski padding. But we must address the final variation of the mortgage rules, which happens when the housing market turns upside down.
The dreaded underwater mortgage scenario.
Listener, what if Ingrid bought a house at the absolute peak of a housing bubble? Let's say her primary residence is currently appraised at $500,000, but her outstanding mortgage balance is $600,000. She's underwater by 100 grand. How does Riley calculate that?
The SEC forces a hyper-conservative view of wealth here. We established earlier that you exclude the mortgage as a liability up to the fair market value of the house.
Right.
Symmetry.
But if the mortgage exceeds the fair market value, that excess debt completely loses its shield. That extra $100,000 in underwater debt flips back and becomes a harsh, undeniable liability that counts directly against her overall net worth. Wait, really? So if Ingrid has $1 million in a brokerage account, but she is underwater on her house by 100K, her official net worth for SEC purposes is only 900,000.
Yes. That toxic real estate debt drags down her other liquid assets.
Wow.
It prevents someone who is technically insolvent due to massive real estate debt from pretending they have the liquid capital to absorb a total loss in a private placement.
Okay, so that is net worth path. It's tricky, but the logic holds up. But wealth isn't just about what you have in the bank, it's also about your earning power. Ingrid has a second pathway to get in, the income test.
Right, the income test shifts the focus from accumulated capital to consistent cash flow. The rule requires an individual to have an income exceeding $200,000 in each of the two most recent years.
200K for a single person.
Or, if they are married or have a spousal equivalent, a joint income exceeding $300,000 in each of the two most recent years.
I'm going to pause the tape right here. Listener, did you hear the exact numbers the expert just used? $200,000 for an individual. $300,000 for a joint couple. Notice the math. It does not simply double. 200 plus 200 does not equal 300 in the SEC's universe.
It really doesn't, yeah. And it is one of the most common exam traps. Test writers will present a scenario where a husband makes $150,000 and the wife makes $150,000.
So together they make $300,000. Are they accredited?
Yes, but the trap answer will often try to trick you into thinking the joint requirement is $400,000. It is not. It is $300,000.
Why is it $300,000? Why doesn't it just double to 400K?
Because the SEC assumes economies of scale in a household. You share a mortgage, you share utilities, right? A couple making $300K jointly actually has similar disposable income to a single person making $200K.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes it easier to remember. Now, there is a second, equally critical component to the income test. It is not enough to just look backward at your old W-2s. The investor must also have a reasonable expectation of reaching that same income level in the current year. I like to call this the running start rule.
The running start rule, that's a good way to frame it. It ensures that the investor's financial capacity hasn't suddenly just collapsed. Past performance does not guarantee current accreditation.
Let me throw a scenario at you, listener.
Okay.
Let's see if you can navigate the running start. Let's say Ingrid was an absolute rock star corporate lawyer in New York City. For the last 2 years, her W-2s show she made $400,000 a year.
She crushed it.
She totally crushed it. But the stress got to her. She got incredibly burned out. On January 1st of this year, she quit her firm, sold her tailored suits, moved to a remote cabin in Montana, and decided to live entirely off the grid.
Wow. Good for her.
Right. She spends her days reading philosophy and foraging for mushrooms. She plans to earn absolutely zero income this year. But today is March 1st. Riley, the rep, calls her up and wants to sell her a private placement based purely on the income test. Is Ingrid accredited?
I will give everyone a beat to process the timeline.
Okay. You're in the exam room. What is the verdict?
The answer is definitively no. She fails the test.
Because of the current year.
Exactly. The current year expectation is mandatory. It is never, ever optional. You cannot simply ride the coattails of a great two-year run if your current financial reality has fundamentally changed. Because Ingrid has zero expectation of earning $200,000 in the current calendar year, her past W-2s are utterly irrelevant.
You need the 2 years of momentum, and you have to prove you are still running at that speed today. If you hit a wall and stop, or if you voluntarily step off the track to go forage for mushrooms, you lose the status instantly.
Instantly. Now, up until very recently, the SEC operated under a rigid, almost dogmatic assumption. Wealth equals sophistication.
Which is crazy if you think about it.
It is. The only way for a natural person to prove they understood financial risk was to show they had a massive pile of money or a massive salary. But the regulations have finally evolved to recognize that financial literacy exists entirely independently of wealth.
This is one of my favorite updates to the rules. It's the professional cheat code.
The SEC now allows individuals holding certain professional certifications in good standing to automatically qualify as accredited investors, regardless of their net worth or their income.
No jet skis required.
No jet skis. The SEC order specifically designated three licenses, the Series 7 General Securities Representative, the Series 65 Investment Advisor Representative, and crucially for our listeners, the Series 82 Private Securities Offerings Representative.
So let's look at the incredible irony of this rule. Think about our guy, Riley the rep.
Yeah.
Riley just passed his Series 82. He is young, he has massive student loans, he lives in a microscopic apartment, and he eats instant ramen for dinner every single night.
Poor Riley.
His net worth is literally negative $50,000. But because his Series 82 license is active and in good standing, Riley the rep is automatically an accredited investor.
The SEC is finally acknowledging that if you can pass a grueling federal exam testing the mechanics of private offerings, rescission, and exempt transactions, you inherently possess the sophistication to evaluate those risks for your own portfolio.
Right. You don't need $1 million to prove, you know, what a restricted security is.
It's a massive win for financial professionals, although we need to be very precise here for the exam. This cheat code is strictly limited to those specific SEC-designated credentials.
Okay, listener, if the exam asks if an investor is accredited because they have a PhD in economics or an MBA from Harvard or they pass the CPA exam, what is the answer?
The answer is no. General education degrees, no matter how prestigious they sound, do not grant accredited status. It must be the 7, the 65, or the 82.
And there is one other non-wealth pathway for individuals, which is the knowledgeable employee exception.
Right. Yes. If you are an executive officer, director, or a knowledgeable employee of a private fund, meaning you actively participate in the investment activities of that specific fund, you are accredited for the purpose of investing in that fund.
It's essentially an in-house perk. You are helping manage the portfolio, so you obviously understand the risks of what your own team is doing.
Right, but you can't take that status across the street. If you are a knowledgeable employee for Sam the Sponsor's real estate fund, that doesn't make you an accredited investor to go buy into some random tech startup across town.
Exactly. The status is permanently tethered to the employer.
Exactly.
Okay, we have completely mapped the individual landscape. We know how human beings get into the club, but let's shift the focus. We solved Ingrid's problem, but Sam the Sponsor needs millions of dollars to fund his next mega deal. He can't just rely on individual human beings writing $50,000 checks. He needs corporate capital. He needs institutional money.
He needs the big whales.
But that creates a massive regulatory headache for Riley the rep. You cannot ask an LLC for its W-2s. You cannot ask a business trust if it recently took out a mortgage on its primary residence. So how does the SEC measure the sophistication of a faceless corporation?
Regulation D tackles this by splitting entity-accredited investors into two distinct operational camps. I categorize them as the status-based VIPs and the threshold-based club.
Status versus threshold.
Okay. The distinction really comes down to whether the entity's very existence implies heavy regulatory oversight.
Let's start with the VIPs. Who gets past the velvet rope without having to show their corporate bank statement?
These are entities that are accredited based purely on what they are. This elite list includes banks, savings and loan associations, registered broker-dealers, SEC-registered investment advisors, insurance companies, registered investment companies like mutual funds, and small business investment companies.
I want to challenge the underlying logic here for a second. Why doesn't an insurance company or a bank have to prove it has a certain amount of assets? If a small regional broker-dealer is like barely scraping by, why does the SEC just give them a free pass to buy highly risky private equity?
Because of overlapping regulatory regimes. The SEC understands that private offerings lack prospectuses. But if you are a bank, you are already heavily regulated by the Federal Reserve and the FDIC.
So they're already under a microscope.
Exactly. If you are an insurance company, you are regulated by state insurance commissioners and armies of actuaries. The SEC assumes that an entity surviving under that level of intense daily regulatory scrutiny already possesses sophisticated risk management protocols.
They don't need a disclosure packet to understand what they are buying.
And the SEC doesn't need to arbitrarily test their balance sheet because bank examiners are literally already doing it.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
The status itself is a proxy for sophistication. And this VIP list also includes issuer insiders, right?
Yes. Any director, executive officer, or general partner of the issuer of the securities is automatically accredited for that specific offering. If Sam, the sponsor, is the CEO of the company raising the money, he knows the internal financials better than anyone.
He doesn't need the government to protect him from his own business plan.
Right.
So for those VIPs, banks, broker-dealers, insurers, insiders, there's absolutely $0 test. But what's about the rest of the corporate world? What if Sam the sponsor wants to bring in a local LLC or a family office or a 501c charity? They aren't regulated by the FDIC. They aren't VIPs.
That brings us to the threshold-based entities. For these groups, their corporate status proves absolutely nothing. A randomly generated LLC could be managed by a retired hedge fund manager, or it could be managed by three teenagers who just discovered day trading on Reddit.
Very true.
So the SEC reverts to the blunt instrument of wealth. They require these entities to prove their sophistication with a massive pile of assets.
Welcome to the $5 million club.
To qualify, these entities generally must possess total assets exceeding $5 million. This applies to 501c3, tax-exempt charities, corporations, Massachusetts, or similar business trusts, partnerships, and LLCs.
Does it apply to family offices too?
It does. Family offices are included provided they have over $5 million in assets under management and are not formed for the specific purpose of acquiring the securities.
Okay, listener, alarms should be ringing in your head right now.
Yeah.
We just hit the biggest, most heavily tested trap in the entity section, the specific purpose trap.
They love to test this.
I want you to visualize Sam, the sponsor. Sam has 50 buddies. They are doctors, lawyers, plumbers, contractors. Each of them has $100,000 to invest, but none of them meets the individual $1 million net worth test. They are all non-accredited.
Individually, they are totally locked out of the private markets.
But Sam thinks he is a legal genius. He says, hey guys, the rules say an LLC with $5 million in assets is accredited. Why don't we just duct tape all 50 of us together? We will form a brand new LLC tomorrow. We'll call it Sam's Awesome Deal LLC. We will all pool our 100 grand, giving the LLC exactly $5 million. Then the LLC will buy into the private offering as a single accredited entity.
The math checks out. The LLC has $5 million in total assets. So, listener, does Sam's duct-taped LLC qualify as an accredited investor?
Think about the intent of the law here. Why would the SEC allow this?
They wouldn't. The answer is a resounding categorical no. The SEC saw Sam's loophole coming from a mile away. Four of the six threshold categories, including corporations, LLCs, trusts, and family offices, carry a strict condition. They fail the accreditation test if they were formed for the specific purpose of acquiring the securities being offered.
If you could just staple non-accredited people together into a fresh LLC to bypass the wealth rules, the rules would be entirely meaningless. The entity must have a legitimate pre-existing business purpose, or at the very least, it cannot have been birthed into existence solely to execute this one exact private transaction.
However, the exam writers love exceptions even more than they love rules. There is a very specific type of entity that carries absolutely no purpose condition whatsoever.
The ERISA exemption.
Exactly. Employee benefit plans, particularly those governed by ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. If Sam, the sponsor, somehow formed an ERISA plan specifically for this deal, it would not be disqualified based on why it was formed.
Wait, why the massive double standard?
Yeah.
Why does the SEC ban a purpose-built LLC but give a totally green light to a purpose-built employee retirement plan?
Because ERISA plans are brutally regulated by the Department of Labor. The DOL imposes incredibly strict fiduciary duties on anyone managing an ERISA plan. The SEC knows that if someone is managing pension money, the Department of Labor is breathing down their neck, threatening massive personal liability for breach of fiduciary duty.
Oh, so the SEC just leans on the DOL's oversight.
Exactly. Therefore, an ERISA plan is tested purely on either its size, having plan assets exceeding $5 million, or its management. If the plan's investment decisions are made by a plan fiduciary, that is a bank, a savings and loan association, an insurance company, or a registered investment advisor, the plan is accredited regardless of its asset size or why it was formed.
That is a brilliant piece of regulatory interplay. The SEC just outsources the sophistication check to the Department of Labor. Okay, so LLCs and trusts formed for the deal. Banned. ERISA plans formed for the deal. Totally fine as long as the fiduciary is a bank or the plan clears $5 million.
There is one final entity rule we must cover before we move on to verification. It is the look-through rule.
This one feels like a logic puzzle. Let's say we have an LLC that has been operating a small business for 10 years. It clears the specific purpose hurdle easily. However, the business has fallen on really hard times. It is completely broke. It has absolutely zero assets in the corporate bank account. It catastrophically fails the $5 million asset test.
So on its face, the entity is non-accredited.
But let's look at the cap table. The LLC is owned exactly 50-50 by two people. The first owner is Ingrid, the investor, who, as we know, has a personal net worth of $5 million. The second owner is Riley, the rep, who holds his active Series 82 license.
This activates the look-through rule. The SEC dictates that if an entity fails the asset tests, but every single equity owner of that entity is independently an accredited investor, the entity itself qualifies as a pass-through. It magically inherits the accredited status of its owners. The LLC can invest.
But the vulnerability of this rule is the chain of ownership.
Yeah.
It requires absolute perfection, right? If Ingrid owns 99.9% of the LLC and she gives 0.1% of the equity to her non-accredited nephew as a birthday gift, what happens to the LLC's status?
The entire structure shatters. You have to trace the equity ownership all the way down to the bedrock. Every single human being or entity you find at the absolute bottom of the structure must be accredited on their own merits. One single non-accredited fractional owner breaks the chain, and the entity fails the look-through rule.
Okay, let's take a deep breath. We've established the ground rules. We understand Inger's personal math, we understand Riley's licensing cheat code, and we understand Sam's corporate threshold traps. We know who is legally allowed in. But knowing the rules isn't the same as enforcing them. This leads to the next massive regulatory headache for Riley the rep.
The verification burden. Trust, but verify.
If Ingrid walks into Riley's office, sits down, and confidently says, "Riley, I'm totally worth $5 million. Trust me, here's a check." Can Riley just execute the trade? Does he just take her word for it?
This is where the history of the JOBS Act of 2012 comes into play, because it created a massive fork in the road for Regulation D. It entirely depends on how Sam's sponsor marketed the deal. We have to navigate the general solicitation dilemma.
The JOBS Act really changed everything. It separated the quiet, behind-closed-doors country club deals from the screaming billboard-on-the-highway deals.
Prior to the JOBS Act, private placements under Rule 506 were strictly forbidden from using general solicitation. You could not advertise. If Sam, a sponsor, is running a traditional no-solicitation private placement today, what we now call Rule 506B, he is only allowed to offer the deal to people he or his broker already has a substantive pre-existing relationship with.
And because the deal is kept quiet, kept within a known network, the SEC's burden of proof is relatively low. Riley the rep just needs a reasonable belief that Ingrid is accredited.
Right. In a quiet 506B deal, if Ingrid fills out an investor questionnaire, checks the box saying her net worth is over $1 million, signs it, and Riley has absolutely no reason to doubt her based on their relationship, that self-certification might be enough to establish a reasonable belief.
But the JOBS Act created Rule 506C. It allowed issuers to shout from the rooftops. Sam, the sponsor, can now buy Super Bowl ads, run Facebook campaigns, send mass emails, and put up billboards for his private placement.
But that unprecedented freedom to solicit the general public came with a heavy regulatory price tag. When you invite the entire world to look at your deal, the SEC wants a much, much taller fence around the pool to keep the retail investors from drowning.
If a deal uses general solicitation under Rule 506C, Riley the rep can no longer rely on a reasonable belief. He has an affirmative legal duty to take reasonable steps to verify that every single purchaser is actually an accredited investor.
And let's be crystal clear here. A bare self-certification Ingrid just swearing on a piece of paper that she's rich absolutely fails in a general solicitation deal. The SEC demands receipts. To help brokers avoid rescission nightmares, the SEC provided a non-exclusive safe harbor checklist of 5 specific verification methods.
Listener, if you are sitting for the Series 82, you need to know the mechanics of these 5 methods cold. Let's dig into the exact paperwork Riley has to demand from Ingrid.
Method 1 is the income basis. If Ingrid claims she is accredited because she makes over $200,000 a year, Riley needs to see the official proof. He must review her official Internal Revenue Service forms W-2s, form 1099s, Schedule K-1s, or copies of filed tax returns for the 2 most recent years.
And tying back to what we learned earlier, do not forget the running start rule. Reviewing the past W-2s is only half the battle. Riley also legally needs a written representation from Ingrid stating that she reasonably expects to reach that exact same income level in the current year. Paperwork for the past, written promise for the future.
Method 2 is the net worth basis. This is significantly more intrusive. Riley needs to review official asset documentation to prove she actually has the $1 million. This means pulling bank statements, brokerage statements, certificates of deposit, or third-party appraisals of assets. And crucially, all of these documents must be dated within the prior 3 months.
But a net worth calculation is assets minus liabilities. How does Riley prove she doesn't have massive secret debts hiding offshore?
Well, he can't entirely. But the SEC forces him to check the obvious avenues. To satisfy the safe harbor, Riley must pull a consumer report from at least one of the nationwide credit reporting agencies like Equifax or Experian, also dated within the prior 3 months.
To smoke out the hidden debt.
Right. The credit report is designed to find the massive auto loans, the maxed out credit cards, or the hidden mortgages that Ingrid might be trying to omit from her balance sheet.
The credit report checks the liability side of the equation. Now, method 3 is perhaps the most common in the real world, because Riley doesn't actually want to sift through Ingrid's personal tax returns and credit reports. It's awkward.
It is awkward. So method 3 is third-party written confirmation. Ingrid can go to a registered broker-dealer, an SEC-registered investment advisor, a licensed attorney, or a certified public accountant, and get them to do the audit. They write a formal letter saying, "We have reviewed the necessary financial documents and we verify that Ingrid is an accredited investor."
Riley takes the letter, puts it in his file, and the burden is shifted. But again, that letter must be dated within the prior 3 months of the sale.
Method 4 is a grandfathered certification. This is a very narrow safe harbor. If Ingrid bought into the exact same issuer's earlier private placement before the JOBS Act rules went into effect in September 2013, and she still holds those original securities, the issuer can essentially grandfather her in. She just has to certify she still qualifies.
And method 5 is prior verification on file. Let's say Riley tortured Ingrid with the W-2s and the credit reports last year for a completely different real estate deal. Does he have to make her pull all new credit reports today for Sam's new deal?
Not if he is within the window. Riley can rely on a prior verification of Ingrid's status for up to 5 years from the date the verification was originally performed.
Not 5 years from the date she bought the last deal, but 5 years from the date the verification was actually executed. That timeline distinction is a classic exam target.
So those are the five methods of the safe harbor. If Riley checks the boxes, he is protected from SEC enforcement. Even if it turns out Ingrid somehow forged the documents, the safe harbor shields the broker.
Okay, let's look at this from a completely different angle. I'm going to throw a massive wrench into this safe harbor concept.
I'm ready.
Let's say Riley the rep is sitting at his desk on a Tuesday morning. He has a pristine, beautifully typed, notarized letter from Ingrid's certified public accountant sitting on his desk. It's dated yesterday. The letter says, "I, the CPA, have reviewed all financial documents and confirm Ingrid the investor has a net worth of $10 million. According to the verification checklist, Riley is golden. Method 3 is perfectly satisfied.
But
Riley gets up to get a coffee. He looks out the window of his high-rise office, which happens to overlook the steps of the federal bankruptcy courthouse. And he sees Ingrid the investor, in tears, walking down the courthouse steps being swarmed by local news reporters because she literally just filed for Chapter 7 personal bankruptcy this exact morning.
Oh, man.
Her entire fortune is gone. It vaporized overnight in a massive offshore fraud scandal. Riley literally watches her sobbing into microphones about being entirely destitute.
This is a phenomenal hypothetical because it perfectly illustrates the philosophical limit of any regulatory safe harbor.
Right. So Riley walks back to his desk. He has the CPA letter from yesterday. The checklist is technically flawlessly complete. Can Riley legally execute the trade and sell her the private shares?
Absolutely. Unequivocally not. The safe harbor is instantly destroyed by what the SEC calls actual knowledge. The five methods provide a shield, but they do not protect you if you possess actual knowledge that contradicts the verification documents. Actual knowledge always, always trumps the checklist.
It's the SEC saying don't turn your brain off just because you have a form filled out in triplicate. You still have to operate in objective reality. If Riley knows for a fact she is bankrupt, he cannot hide behind a piece of paper saying she is rich, no matter how official the signature is.
The overarching theme of the Series 82 is that you cannot willfully ignore reality just to earn a commission.
Okay, so we've solved the front half of the life cycle. Ingrid and Sam have proven their status. They navigated the verification. The money changes hands, and the initial offering closes.
But the life cycle of a private security doesn't end there.
Exactly. Fast forward 1 year, Ingrid is holding this restricted, unregistered paper from Sam's startup. It hasn't gone public. She wants out. She wants liquidity. She wants to sell the paper and buy a yacht. But she can't just log onto a retail brokerage app and dump restricted private shares onto the open public market. The paper is legally locked. It is radioactive to retail investors.
This introduces the absolute need for a secondary market for private debt and equity. If institutional investors knew they could never, ever sell private securities, they would never buy them in the first place, and the capital markets would totally freeze.
So enter the next tier of our regulatory ecosystem, designed specifically to provide that liquidity, the qualified institutional buyer, or QIB.
And the mechanism that allows them to trade is the QIB private resale safe harbor, heavily associated with the concepts of Rule 144.
To understand the safe harbor, we must strictly define who is allowed to use it. What is a QIB?
A qualified institutional buyer is an institution, not a human being, ever, that owns and invests on a discretionary basis at least $100 million in securities of unaffiliated issuers.
$100 million. Listener, I need you to notice the specific noun the expert just used. It is not $100 million in assets. It is $100 million in securities.
This distinction is paramount. For an entity trying to become an accredited investor, we looked at total assets. Total assets can include the company headquarters, the real estate, the fleet of company cars, the office furniture. But for a QIB, the SEC aggressively narrows the focus. They only care about investment securities. Stocks, bonds, treasury notes, instruments of finance.
If a manufacturing corporation owns a $150 million factory, but only has $2 million in a corporate brokerage account, they might be an accredited entity, but they are absolutely not a QIB.
And it must be discretionary. The institution must have their hands on the steering wheel. If a massive custodial bank is just holding custody of $200 million for its retail clients, but the bank doesn't have the legal authority to decide how to invest that money, the bank is not a QIB based on those specific holdings.
The QIB is the apex predator of the financial markets. Now, there are a few exceptions to the $100 million rule. The first discount goes to registered broker-dealers. A registered dealer only needs $10 million in securities owned and invested to qualify as a QIB.
Why the $90 million discount? Because dealers are in the business of making markets. They provide the grease that keeps the wheels of liquidity turning. The SEC desperately wants to encourage liquidity in the private markets, so they intentionally lower the barrier to entry for the professionals whose literal full-time job is buying and selling securities.
Okay, so dealers get a massive discount. Who gets the raw end of the deal? Who has the hardest time becoming a QIB?
That would be banks and savings and loan associations. For a bank to qualify as a QIB, it must meet the standard $100 million securities test. And ADD, it must simultaneously prove it has an audited net worth of at least $25 million.
Wait, why double punish the banks? They need the massive securities portfolio, Andy. A massive audited net worth. What is the SEC so afraid of?
It stems from the systemic paranoia of the Federal Reserve and the FDIC. Banks carry federally insured retail deposits. The entire regulatory framework is hypersensitive to bank insolvency. The SEC and banking regulators want to ensure that a bank isn't just shuffling around $100 million of highly leveraged, illiquid private securities while teetering on the edge of bankruptcy.
So the secondary net worth test proves institutional stability.
It proves the bank has the actual capital buffer to absorb the risk of holding restricted, illiquid paper.
Okay, so we know who the QIBs are. Now, let's look at how they operate within the safe harbor. What does the QIB private resale safe harbor actually do?
Let's go back to Ingrid. She is holding restricted securities. The safe harbor allows Ingrid, or Riley the rep acting on her behalf, to resell those restricted securities directly to a QIB without having to register the transaction with the SEC. The QIBs trade this paper among themselves constantly, often using specialized electronic systems like the portal market.
So Ingrid finds a massive insurance company QIB. She sells her restricted paper to them. The transaction is perfectly legal. But here is the massive fundamental exam trap that catches so many test takers. Listener, listen closely. If a QIB buys restricted paper from Ingrid, does the paper magically become unrestricted?
I will state this as emphatically as the regulations allow. No. The safe harbor exempts the transaction, not the securities.
I like to use the hazmat analogy here. Think of a restricted security as a block of highly radioactive material. The general public cannot handle it. You will destroy them. The SEC requires buyers to wear a financial hazmat suit, meaning they have to be highly sophisticated. A QIB has the ultimate heavy-duty hazmat suit. So Ingrid is allowed to pass the radioactive block to the QIB. The transfer is safe. But passing the block to a guy in a hazmat suit doesn't magically cure the radiation. The block itself is still radioactive.
Exactly. The restricted nature of the security travels with the paper. It just moved from Ingrid's safe to the QIB's vault. If the insurance company wants to sell it a month later, they cannot just dump it on the New York Stock Exchange. They either have to find another QIB to buy it under Rule 144, or they have to wait out a legal holding period under Rule 144, or the issuer has to fully register the shares.
The restriction is a curse that sticks to the paper. And speaking of holding periods, it is vital to remember that the QIB safe harbor itself has zero holding period requirement.
Right. If Ingrid bought the restricted paper on Monday and she suddenly needs cash on Tuesday, she can legally resell it to a QIB under this safe harbor on Tuesday afternoon. The safe harbor is entirely defined by who is buying it, the institution status, not by how long Ingrid held it.
Let's address one final communications trap regarding QIBs. The exam loves to test if you know the difference between an institutional investor and a qualified institutional buyer.
They sound identical to a layperson, but legally they are worlds apart.
Let's say we have an incredibly rich individual, a tech billionaire. This natural person has $1 billion in personal securities. He is an absolute titan of finance. Under certain fine and rat communication rules, Riley the rep might treat this billionaire as an institutional investor for the sake of sending him complex institutional-grade marketing materials without the standard retail disclosures. Does that make the billionaire a QIB?
Never. A natural person can never, ever be a QIB. I don't care if they have $50 billion in personal wealth and a PhD in quantitative finance. QIB status is strictly, exclusively for entities and institutions. The words qualified institutional buyer mean exactly what they say.
Okay, we are making incredible time through this minefield. We have conquered accredited investors. We have conquered QIBs. But there is one final boss in this regulatory video game. We have to introduce a third, totally separate status.
The qualified purchaser.
And I know exactly what you were thinking, listener.
Yeah.
Why do we need a third term? We have accredited investors for the initial deals. We have QIBs for the resales. Are the regulators just making up words to torture me?
It absolutely feels that way. But we need this third term because it solves a completely different, massively important regulatory problem. Accredited investors gate who can buy the initial offering. QIBs gate who can buy the restricted resales. Qualified purchasers exist to solve the existential problem of the 100 investor cap for private funds.
To understand this, we have to look back at the Investment Company Act of 1940. Following the Great Depression, Congress realized that pooling retail money into massive, unregulated investment funds created terrifying systemic risk. So they passed the 1940 Act, which forces mutual funds to register, to cap their leverage, and to operate with total transparency.
But Sam, the sponsor, doesn't want to run a transparent retail mutual fund. He wants to run a dark, aggressive, highly leveraged private equity fund. Under the 1940 Act, specifically Section 3C1, Sam is allowed to run a private fund without registering it, but he is legally capped at having 100 investors.
100 investors. If he lets investor number 101, he violates the 1940 Act, the SEC cracks down, and his private fund is destroyed.
That 100 investor limit is a massive bottleneck for ambitious sponsors who want to raise billions of dollars. But in 1996, Congress created an escape hatch. It's called the Section 3C7 Qualified Purchaser Fund Exclusion.
The holy grail for private funds.
If Sam builds his fund and he ensures that every single investor in that fund meets the definition of a qualified purchaser, the 100 investor cap completely vanishes. He can have 500, 1,000, 10,000 investors and still avoid the heavy hand of the Investment Company Act.
Being a qualified purchaser is the golden ticket to unlimited fund size. But how rich do you have to be to hold that ticket? Let's define the math.
The barrier to entry is staggering. For a natural person or a family-owned company, a qualified purchaser must own at least $5 million in investments. For an institutional buyer, they must own and invest at least $25 million in investments.
$5 million for humans, $25 million for institutions. But listener, I need you to circle, highlight, and underline the word investments, because this is where the exam will try to bleed you. We need to compare this directly to the accredited test to see the friction.
Let's do that comparison. Remember, the entity accredited investor test, the $5 million club.
Right. An LLC needed $5 million in total assets to be accredited.
Let's say an LLC owns a massive warehouse facility. The building is worth $6 million. They use it every single day as their operating premises to manufacture widgets. Are they an accredited entity?
Yes, because the factory counts toward their total assets on the balance sheet.
Now let's take a natural person trying to become a qualified purchaser. They need $5 million in investments. Let's say this person owns a piece of real estate worth $6 million, but it's a working farm that they actively operate, or it's a massive estate that they live in. Are they a qualified purchaser?
No, because the SEC draws a hard line here. Real estate only counts as an investment if it is held strictly for investment purposes, like an apartment building you rent out for passive income. Property used for personal use or property used as a place of active business completely drops out of the qualified purchaser calculation.
The base for a qualified purchaser is materially more restrictive. $5 million in pure investments is astronomically harder to achieve than $5 million in total assets, or a $1 million net worth.
It is the tightest filter in the entire ecosystem. But here is the most fascinating part of this whole regulatory web. We have mapped out these three distinct islands. Accredited investors, QIBs, and qualified purchasers. Are they connected?
They are not simply stacked tiers. You cannot blindly assume that clearing one hurdle automatically clears the others. However, there is exactly one highly specific legal bridge that connects these islands.
The one bridge rule.
The rule states that a qualified institutional buyer a QIB acting for its own account or the account of another QIB is legally deemed to be a qualified purchaser.
Let's trace the logic of that bridge. A QIB is an institution with $100 million in securities. A qualified purchaser institution needs $25 million in investments. The logic is bulletproof. If you possess $100 million in securities, you easily, mathematically clear the $25 million investment bar.
Whoa.
The SEC simply formalized the math and connected the dots.
But the Series 82 exam writers will try to push you off that bridge. I want you to anticipate this exact trap. The question will ask, does the fact that a QIB is deemed a qualified purchaser mean a QIB is automatically legally deemed an accredited investor too?
Let's see. The bridge goes from QIB to QP. Does it extend to accredited?
The answer is definitively no. The legal statuses do not automatically bridge to accredited. Now, if we look at objective reality, a $100 million QIB is obviously going to meet the $5 million asset test to be an accredited entity. The raw numbers work. But legally speaking, within the strict text of the regulations, there is no specific rule that says a QIB is deemed an accredited investor.
So if an exam question asks, which status is a QIB legally deemed to hold? The answer is qualified purchaser, full stop. Do not let them trick you into selecting all of the above just because the math implies it. Stick to the letter of the law.
Precisely. Each status is defined and tested under its own specific rule for its own specific regulatory purpose. Accredited investor status gates the initial private offering. QIB status gates the private resale market. Qualified purchaser status gates the 1940 Act fund exclusion.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground. We have unpacked the history, the friction, and the mechanics of these rules. I want to organize my mental study notes right now. And listener, I want you to do this with me. Let's do a rapid fire recap.
Let's do it.
I'm going to throw out scenarios. I'll pause for you to think, and the expert will give us the punchline. Ready? Prompt one. Who uses the $1 million test?
That would be the individual accredited investor, net worth excluding the primary residence.
Awesome. Prompt two. Who uses the $5 million test?
Two groups. The entity accredited investor, which tests total assets, and the natural person qualified purchaser, which tests investments only.
Great distinction. Prompt three. Who uses the $100 million test?
QIBs, qualified institutional buyers. And remember, that's $100 million in securities, not assets.
Got it. Prompt four. If I form a brand new LLC specifically to pool money and buy into a deal, which test do I fail?
You fail the $5 million entity accredited test, unless, of course, you're an ERISA plan.
The ERISA exception. And final prompt. Does the QIB safe harbor wash away the restricted status of the security?
Absolutely not. It only exempts the resale transaction. The paper stays restricted.
Perfect. We have taken the regulatory maze and given you the map.
Before we close, I want to leave the listener with a broader, somewhat philosophical thought to ponder as they memorize these thresholds. We have spent this entire deep dive talking about millions of dollars, $1 million, $5 million, $25 million, $100 million. Our entire federal securities framework relies almost exclusively on raw dollar amounts to define sophistication.
The SEC's baseline assumption is that if you have money, you inherently know what you are doing.
But we must ask, does having $5 million in passive real estate investments actually make someone inherently better at reading a complex corporate balance sheet or understanding the liquidity risk of a dark pool resale than a completely broke 24-year-old who just graduated with a master's degree in quantitative finance?
The recent addition to the professional licenses, the Series 82 cheat code, shows the SEC is starting to crack on this issue.
They are starting to crack, but the vast majority of the regulations still fundamentally assume that wealth equals financial literacy. Or, perhaps more cynically, the rules assume that massive wealth shields you from the consequences of your own ignorance because you can afford to absorb the total loss of the investment. It is a fascinating and highly debatable premise that props up the very rules you are about to be tested on.
It is the unspoken philosophy behind every single threshold we just dissected. It's something to chew on while you are grinding through those practice exams. Listener, take these mental models, Ingrid's jet skis and her 60-day look-back trap, Riley's actual knowledge overriding his paperwork, Sam's purpose-built LLCs, and his quest for a 3C7 fund, take them with you into your Series 82. Understand the mechanics, respect the hazards of rescission, and you've got this. Good luck on test day.